Hello and welcome to History of Asia. A few weeks ago, we dissected the abrupt fall of the Safavids, Iran's most impactful Muslim dynasty. We saw that their collapse would have grave consequences, not just for Iran, but for the whole of Asia. It enabled the rise of Nadir, a formidable but also formidably aggressive warlord who fatally injured the Mughal Empire and severely weakened the Ottomans. If the rise of the West was indeed preceded and enabled by the decline of the rest, then this was clearly one of the main events that started it. But were the Safavids only important due to the aftershocks of their demise? Of course not. It was they who reunited the lands in and around Iran. The fact that they kept a hold of it for over two centuries, that would seriously strengthen the Persians' collective identity. The fact that they were in constant tension with their surroundings contributed to Iran's lasting siege mentality. They also instilled within this identity its most typical characteristic, Twelver Shiism. You simply cannot understand this country if you ignore its national creed. Today, we shall see how the Twelver sect, if that's the proper term for it, became dominant in Iran, as well as in other places that fell under the Safavid sway at that point, like Bahrain, Azerbaijan, and most of Iraq. Today, the large majority of Iranians adheres to Twelver Shiism, but it was the Safavids who instilled it into a mostly Sunni population. With force. If you ever wondered whether a religion can effectively be spread by the sword, then here you will find your answer. The most remarkable thing of all, perhaps, is that these Safavids hadn't been Shiite themselves for all that long. Was this the typical fanaticism of the recent convert then? Or were there more earthly calculations in play? Let's find out. We'll have to start by tracing the roots of this illustrious dynasty. Who were these Safavids? Well, strictly speaking, they were not themselves Iranians. They were mostly Turkmens, nomads from the steppe. The fact that they were foreigners may seem strange, given their impact on Iran and its culture and history and identity. But this is not that rare. Nomadic peoples from Central Asia have spawned some of the greatest empires of all time. In China, for instance, you had a dynasty ruled by Mongols, then another by Yurchen, another by Manchus, and so on. In India, the Mughal Empire was also founded by steppe nomads, just like the Ottoman Empire. The Turks themselves originated in Central Asia. So it's not at all exceptional to have a great civilization dominated by people that were once regarded as barbarians there. Besides, don't we all come from somewhere else at some point? The Mughals, the Ottomans, and the Safavids were all part of the ultimate gulf of steppe invaders. They eventually became known as the Gunpowder Empires. Somewhat ironically, for the age of gunpowder would prove the beginning of the end for the long military dominance of the nomadic horse archers. The Safavids would end up as typical Persian shahs, but they started off as a messianic Sufi cult. And just to be clear, this was a Sunni cult originally, not a Shiite one. Their order was founded in the 1100s, somewhere around Azerbaijan. At its inception, it was focused on the spiritual, but it already had the potential to be used for military purposes. The Sufis owed obedience to their sheikhs. They had to follow their instructions so that they could teach them how to come closer to God. It's not hard to see, I think, that such unconditional loyalty creates opportunities for a sheikh with political ambitions. Sufism was very popular in this period, especially among the nomads who only recently converted to Islam. Sufism, in fact, made it easier for them to embrace their new faith, since some Sufi practices were reminiscent of the shamanistic rituals they had practiced on the steppe. For this and other reasons, they found it much more appealing than the more bookish ways of practicing Islam. Because of their tribal background, it's only natural that they found the legalistic approach of the ulama tiring and inaccessible. In a way, both Sufis and shamans try to establish direct contact with the divine. In theory, there are plenty of differences, of course, but in practice, these were not always that obvious. The Safavids didn't bother too much about the customs and beliefs that were supposed to distinguish Muslims from other people. They drank a lot of alcohol, for example, and they didn't mind idolizing their leaders. none more so than the man who would bring Iran under the sof of its sway, Ismail. He would pose as a reincarnation of Ali, or you could almost say as some sort of demigod. On occasion, he would even go so far as to order his men to cut up and eat an enemy, whether as part of a shamanistic ritual or to prove their devotion to him. Now, it goes without saying that a very large majority of Muslims would find such practices outright shocking then as now. From an early phase, the Safavid order attracted many Turkmen horse nomads. These were impressive warriors, and in the 15th century, their fighting qualities would be put to use. This new militancy was driven by both necessity and opportunity. The push factors originated in the west of the Safavids' homeland, while the pull factors, on the other hand, lay to the east, so that's where the Safavids would lead their followers. The frightful warlord Tamerlane had, in his day, united much of Inner Asia, but his dynasty quickly crumbled after his death. As politics abhors a vacuum, this led to immense turbulence. The Ottomans had earlier been humiliated by Tamerlane. He had captured their Sultan Bayezid and carried him around in a cage for his amusement. But on the periphery of Tamerlane's empire, the Ottomans managed to survive. Once their nemesis had left the scene and his empire had imploded, the Ottomans simply picked up their expansion as if nothing had happened. In so doing, they drove Turkmen tribes from their pasture land, some of whom flocked to the Safavids. They would go on to form the Kizilbash, whom we already encountered in the last episode. These Turkmen warriors would go on to form a prime pillar of the Iranian elite until well into modern times. Nadir Shah was part of a Kizilbash tribe, so were the Qajar Shahs, and even Mossadegh. That is remarkable, considering that when they took over the land of Iran, they hadn't even existed that long as a separate group. In fact, they didn't even come from a single area. Their tribal name refers to their region of origin. For instance, the Shamlu came from Syria or Al-Sham, while the Rumlu came from Turkey. Constantinople was known as the New Rome. The names Afshar and Qajar refer to different regions in Azerbaijan. All these groups of refugees would be molded together through adherence to a single leader. By the way, this is often how new peoples are created. The Mongols, the Goths, and the Uzbeks have similar origins, for example. In the first series on Arabia, we saw that in tribal societies, vendettas often obstruct grand alliances. Broadly speaking, there are two things that can overcome such differences: greed and religion. Quite often, the two were intertwined. It can be hard to suggest that people should stop squabbling over honor, simply because it would be more rewarding to rob a rich outsider. Valuing greed over honor can seem, well, dishonorable, especially to people who care a lot about such things. Except when the outsider can be labeled an evil infidel. Then it suddenly seems like the noble thing to do. The Safavids fit into this pattern perfectly. The wars that they fought were often aimed against Christians, so they could readily be framed as jihad. If one of their leaders then died in these battles, he was often treated as a martyr who had fallen for a holy cause. These martyr cults enhanced loyalty to the dead man's successor. And this may suggest a reason why, at this point, the Safavids chose to switch from Sunnism to Shiism. I think I mentioned earlier that martyr cults play a key role in Shiism, especially the one around the Prophet's grandson Imam Hussein. Sunnis, by contrast, frown upon such practices, which they consider idol worship. The eccentric red hats that the Kizilbash became known for refer to the blood of Hossein and to martyrs' blood in general. Thanks to the wars in the Caucasus, the Safavids now had plenty of martyrs of their own. Other holy wars would follow, with other glorious deaths. It's commonly known that martyrdom still plays an important role in Iranian culture, and that this is encouraged by the current regime. This may be shrewd, but it's certainly not original, for in Iran, the practice is literally centuries old. So shifting to Shiism allowed the Safavids to harness the respect for their fallen heroes. Ismail, the man who founded the Safavid dynasty, was in a perfect position to take advantage of this. The leadership of the Sufi order had passed down from father to son, and this way he was just a boy when he became the movement's nominal leader. Although he hated the Ottomans with a vengeance, as well as the Christians, the reality was that the real opportunities were to be found in the land of Iran. There, what was left of Tamerlane's former empire was taken over by successive Turkmen confederations, known by the benign-sounding names Black Sheep and White Sheep. Like nearly all Turkic invaders, they embraced Persian court etiquette and administration. Through them, this would be passed on to Ismail's dynasty in time. Now, at first, the White Sheep were still more formidable than the Safavids, but their Khan was troubled by their rise. So anxious to keep them in check, he forced Ismail's grandfather to come live at his court as an honored guest, in air quotes. Now, he was not a simple hostage, for he was also given the Khan's sister in marriage. Later, Ismail's father would marry the Khan's daughter, and she in turn was born to a Byzantine princess whom the Khan had taken for his wife. This meant that Ismail was not only part of a line of famed Sufi sheikhs, he also had the royal blood of the Byzantines in his veins, and he was related to the Khan of the White Sheep. And rest assured, he needed no one to remind him of his glorious lineage. He called himself Shah long before he had conquered an actual kingdom. His link to the White Sheep, by the way, also fed his hatred towards the Ottomans, as it was they who finally overthrew the Khan in 1473. But although this may have angered Ismail, it also created a power vacuum for him to fill. But Ismail was already the nominal leader of the Kizilbash since he was a teenager. Now, normally, you could expect that the men around him could boss him about. That's what usually happens in such cases. But remarkably, not in this case. It seems likely that the Kizilbash chiefs indeed regarded Ismail as some sort of mascot at first, but the fact that they won surprising victories now, that made them feel like this lad brought them good fortune. And somehow, he became the man in charge very quickly. To imagine what this must have been like, I've been looking for a present-day analogy, but it wasn't easy to find. Today, there are few untested people, let alone children, who get to run a major corporation or an army. So here's what I came up with. Suppose we have a football team that performs worse than it should. Let's say Real Madrid. To suit the fans, they appoint a former star of the team as token manager. A gifted player, sure, but someone who has never been coach of any first team. Like, Zinedine Zidane, perhaps. Now, let's imagine, just for the sake of the argument, that in reality, the players pretty much get to decide how they play for themselves, that the coach is merely there to inspire and motivate them through his presence. But by hook or by crook, they soon find themselves top of the league. How long would it take until this mascot coach became the darling of fans and players alike? And how long until he was really the one who has the final say within the club? I don't think that would take 3 Champions League trophies. Now, I'm not saying that this is how things really went down under Zidane, who proved beyond doubt that he was a fine coach all along, but it was still a gamble of Madrid to appoint someone who was untested as head coach. And as he starts believing in his own special qualities, you then run the risk of seeing some very unorthodox decisions along the way, I think. Again, perhaps not so under Zidane, but certainly so with Ismail. The Kizilbash accepted him as their token leader because of his famous name. But because of the military successes that were to follow, he earned their respect. And this allowed him to become his own man, astonishingly fast. It seems that it was he who decided, single-handedly, that the Iranian population should forcibly be converted to Shiism. He took this momentous decision against the advice of his Kizilbash chiefs. For this, I could think of no present-day comparison whatsoever. Do you know any teenagers who would or could make that sort of decision today? In my soccer metaphor, this would amount to Zidane suddenly deciding that Real Madrid should henceforth call themselves Barcelona. If that seems absurd, that's because it is. But it helps put things in perspective. What Ismail did was much worse still. I know that football is sometimes called a religion, but this was about actual religion. in a time in which, to our standards, most people could be considered religious fanatics. And unlike most football fanatics, many were ready to kill or die for it. Their eternal soul depended on it. Now picture this. Most Iranians had learned to adore the first three caliphs. Now they were told to curse them. Likewise, they regarded Aisha as one of the most exemplary people in history. Now they had to slander her. If you force Real Madrid supporters to wear red and blue and renounce all their former stars, I imagine things would get ugly. But again, what is a soccer game compared to the fight between good and evil, of heaven and hell? I think you cannot overstress it enough. What Ismail did was simply madness. And the most astonishing thing was, they let him do it. Zidane could have won 20 trophies for all I care. The moment he announced something like this, he would have to go looking for another job. Not so with Ismail. In a way, it only enhanced his stature. That might have been his motif. It's plain that he envisioned for himself a divinely inspired form of leadership. He wanted to be seen as a heaven-sent savior, as it were. The perfect guide, he called himself. He was nearly deified by his core supporters already, but this estranged many Muslims, no doubt. As we've seen, Sunni Islam is weary of worshipping anything or anyone but God, but Shiism could legitimize Ismail's position as someone who was, if not semi-divine, then at least a few rungs above common mortals. Unlike the caliphs, the Shiite imams were credited with a unique spiritual insight, something that Orthodox Sunnis would consider dangerously close to claims of prophethood. On top of that, Shiism focused a lot on the expected return of the hidden imam, or the Mahdi. Judging from the poems he wrote, it's conceivable that he truly imagined himself as the hidden imam, or something similar. His spectacular military exploits further boosted his self-esteem, as well as his followers' devotion to him. Starting in 1501, in about 10 years, he conquered a huge territory in and around Iran. The people he found there were mainly Sunnis. Not coincidentally, Sunnism emphasizes that there must be no dissension or fitna among Muslims, and that they therefore belong under one authority, that of the caliph. But Shiites, on the other hand, regarded all caliphs as usurpers. According to them, the leadership of the community ought to lie with the imams, the successors to Ali. And according to 12 Shiites, the last of the imams, number 12, had gone into obscurity long ago. So every earthly ruler was by definition illegitimate in their eyes. No wonder they had a difficult relationship with the authorities. This doubly applied to the isolated Shiite communities in the Iranian mountains, who were fond of their autonomy anyway. By turning Twelver Shiism into a state religion, Ismail was able to reconcile these headstrong people with his rule. If you can't beat them, join them. In time, however, as the authorities in Iran itself became officially Shiite, the relationship between the crown and the faith became extremely complex. With Shiite clerics in charge, this is now more the case than ever. Finally, making conversion mandatory could have been a means of self-preservation. If the coach of Real Madrid appears in a Barcelona shirt, he could expect criticism and mockery at the very least. It would certainly not help his authority. Trying to persuade people to follow his example wouldn't make any difference either. It might become a different matter, however, if everyone were forced to wear red and blue on the pain of death. Ismail, too, was well aware that the Iranians would never voluntarily embrace Shiism, so he resorted to methods that can only be called terroristic. He sent propagandists onto the street who loudly denounced and cursed the three first caliphs, the ones who supposedly had usurped Ali's rightful position. These denouncers, as they were called, then forced standers-by to join in. And what happened to those who didn't feel like doing this? They were made an example of. In Tabriz alone, many thousands were butchered for this reason. Like Ismail envisioned, no doubt, this frightened other cities into silence. After Tabriz, there were relatively few who resisted his religious policies anymore. Isn't fear a wonderful thing? But it wasn't just fear alone. practicing Islam the Sunni way was made much harder. For crucially, all Sunni ulama had to convert openly as well. Those that did this thereby set an example that convinced common people to do the same. Needless to say, there were also many who refused, presumably most of them even, but they wouldn't be around to tell the tale. So there were many vacancies opening up within the religious establishment. To fill these positions, Ismail had a bright idea of inviting Shiite scholars from elsewhere, and he found many willing candidates in Lebanon. Shiites were persecuted there, whilst in Iran they could expect lots of respect and a life of privilege. Of course, these ulama would prove dependable, as they had no local power base of their own. Most didn't even speak Persian. The ulama would only become a strong separate power after they put down roots. This mostly started in the 17th century. We've seen the far-reaching consequences of that in the last episode. So the people who might have inspired a resistance were either co-opted or done away with and replaced. Without them, it quickly became hard simply to practice the Sunni faith. But there were other obstacles to this. Even the shrines where Sunnis used to gather were obliterated. These days, it's mostly Sunni Salafists who tend to destroy Shiite shrines. But at this time, Ismail's Shiites didn't hesitate to participate in such iconoclasm either. For instance, they laid waste to the shrine of Abu Hanifa, the founder of the Hanafi school of thought. To replace the Sunni institutions, the Shah invested a lot of money in the development of Shiite ones. This enabled the further development of Shiite jurisprudence, which in turn led to disputes over who could interpret the holy text, how, and to what extent. In the following centuries, Iran would witness a doctrinal split between the Akbari and the Usuli school of ulama, who basically debated over arguments that had already caused controversy in the Sunni world centuries ago. So the reign of the Safavids changed the development of Twelver Shiism itself. Their long-term impact on political culture, however, would be just as important. There had been a strong mutual aversion between the Safavids and the Ottomans already. Now, with Iran turning Shiite, everything was set for a holy war. Like other revolutions, this one had the potential to spill over the border. There were many Shiite communities inside Ottoman lands, and some of them took inspiration from the Safavids' early victories. Indeed, there were copycat insurrections, even close to the Ottoman heartland in Turkey. Of course, the Sultan was not going to sit and watch this revolution expand. He wanted to kill this new Safavid regime in the cradle. This is very similar to what happened just after the Islamic Revolution of 1979, namely an invasion from the Sunni neighbor to the west. Like Khomeini, Ismail also did little to avoid foreign conflicts. Just consider how he handled the Uzbeks, another new Sunni power that would be Iran's neighbor for a long time. The Uzbeks were a tribal confederacy that emerged just north of Iran around the same time as Ismail conquered his empire. His Uzbek counterpart was Shaiban Khan. Ismail was eager to take him on, but it must be said that the Uzbeks provided ample provocation, for instance by plundering the shrine of the 8th Shiite Imam. Eventually, Shaiban was killed in the fighting, and what Ismail did at that point shows that he was not trying to make any friends around there. He flayed the skin of the Khan's head and sent it to the Ottoman Sultan. His arm was cut off and sent to Babur, who was on the verge of founding the Mughal Empire at that point. Shaiban's skull was turned into Ismail's personal drinking cup, a cool gadget to liven up his nights of drinking. Finally, the rest of the body was eaten by some of Ismail's Kizilbash devotees. Ugh. Charming man, right? Where I come from, if you move to another locality, it's customary to ask the neighbors over for a chat and perhaps some coffee. Goes without saying that this was not exactly an invitation to warm neighborly relations. During the war with Iraq, Iran's slogan would be something like, "Neither East nor West, but the Islamic Republic." In other words, it's us against the world. And Ismail, it seems, had very much the same idea. From his perspective, a contrarian attitude made sense. When they started their revolution, Ismail and Khomeini both had plenty of internal enemies to deal with. Some defied them openly, others were biding their time, lurking in the shadows. As we've seen, by attacking Iran, Saddam Hussein only managed to unite the Iranians against him and behind their leader. He thereby gave Khomeini's regime an ideological foundation, a siege mentality that is still exploited to this day. Same was true of the Ottomans' attempt at restoration in Iran. Persian captives were sold off as slaves. So they were lumped in with Ismail's lot, whether they were convinced Shiites or not. For Iran, the conflict turned into a great patriotic war. Again, as in the war with Saddam Hussein, the ideological conflict began on the home front. The Safavids had terrorized and massacred Sunnis in their domain already. Now, the remaining Sunnis were associated with the invader and therefore discredited. Ismail had also developed an elaborate network of spies that had to root out Sunni sympathizers. Meanwhile, the Ottomans had started their own purges. In a move that reminds one of Saddam's handling of Iraqi Shiites, Sultan Salem ordered the killing and banishment of tens of thousands of Shiites in his realm. The Mufti of Istanbul declared that to kill one Shiite would equal killing 70 Christians, which was a good thing, apparently. In droves, the beleaguered Shiites sought and found asylum in Iran, which further contributed to the Shiite character of Iran, of course, and the other lands that the Safavids controlled at the time. Repeated rounds of migration and sectarian cleansing would ensure that the ideological divide became a sort of iron curtain that ran across the Middle East. In a way, it has now been revived by the new Cold War between Iran and Saudi Arabia. But the current one would have been inconceivable were it not for the war between the Safavids and their Sunni enemies centuries ago. The hostilities between the Ottomans and the Safavids were accompanied by rounds of trash talk between their respective rulers. Sultan Salem denounced Ismail as the devil incarnate. He in turn responded disdainfully, even sent a box of opium for Salem's opium-addicted secretaries. He also informed Salem that he was not really in the mood for a fight, since he was too busy hunting. Which, unbelievably, was actually true. Ismail had clearly started to believe in his own propaganda. For while the Ottomans were coming straight at him, with one of the most impressive armies in the world, he and his men were drinking from dusk till dawn. And then he set out to go hunting, with the battle already in full swing. So either he counted on Allah to ensure his victory, or he was looking forward to his martyrdom. Neither would come to pass, however. He was resoundingly defeated, but he managed to escape with his life. Like his grandfather, the Khan of the White Sheep, Ismail was defeated by the Ottomans' superior firepower. Perhaps he knew that the Ottoman artillery was so formidable, but he reckoned that it was mostly effective against fortresses. That might explain why he chose to fight on an open plain. But once the cannons got the Kizilbash firmly in their crosshairs, they proved just how deadly they could be. It was only much later that Abbas the Great would finally take this lesson to heart. He would turn the Safavids into a true gunpowder empire, only for his successors to turn back the reform yet again. However, perhaps it wasn't all that stupid to place so much importance on the cavalry. After all, that had been the winning tactic of the Safavids' ancestors for ages. They could never hope to defeat their enemies at their own game. And besides, the Iranian terrain was not conducive to the sort of warfare that the Ottomans increasingly preferred, with innumerable disciplined infantry and heavy artillery. Their baggage trains and cannon had trouble traversing the treacherous terrain of Iran. The Safavids could resort to scorched earth tactics if need be. The difference in terrain between Iran and Mesopotamia served as something of a natural border at the time. This all but ensured an equilibrium of sorts in which no party could hope to wipe out the other, especially since they both faced hostilities on other flanks. The Ottomans had the Habsburgs to worry about, for instance, while the Safavids had to keep an eye on the Uzbeks. This explains why the victory at Chaldiran wasn't followed up with the obliteration of the hated Safavid regime. Salem would not attempt to take Persia in its entirety. Instead, he simply blocked its access to Europe. Like the Islamic Revolution of 1979, The Safavid Revolution was not snuffed out, but it was stopped in its tracks and quarantined. The stage was set for a long Cold War. Salem returned home, but not before sacking the Persian capital of the time, Tabriz. Ironically, he didn't just take along a lot of treasure, but also a great many artists and artisans, who ensured that Persian culture would flourish in the Ottoman court, even more than was already the case. There were many voluntary Persian emigrants too. Intellectuals fled the persecutions and the stifling ideological climate and found refuge with the Ottomans or in Mughal India. While Persian culture became ever more dominant in the Ottoman and Mughal courts, ironically, the court language of the Persian capital was still Turkish. For Ismail, the result of this era-defining battle at Chalderon was a grave disappointment. I imagine he would have liked it more if he had died that day. He himself barely escaped capture, but his favorite wife did not. He must have regretted bringing her along then, for the Sultan married her off to one of his underlings. Ismail pleaded in vain for her return, but she remained a captive, even after the Sultan had her new husband beheaded. Abbas Amanat speculates that this may have been because he consummated the marriage, while the whole affair was only meant to stick it to Ismail. Ismail's heart was broken, but he found some solace in the arms of other lovers, it seems, both male and female. It's perhaps worth noting that, as a rule, this was not considered so scandalous under the Safavids. It was even depicted by artists. I find that somewhat ironic, considering that Ahmadinejad recently declared that homosexuality was a phenomenon that, well, simply didn't exist in Iran. New lovers or not, Ismail was never the same. Deeply depressed, he retreated from public life. He died at the early age of 37, after spending his final days in the harem, drinking and hunting. The founder of this iconic dynasty had been a very strange guy that I find impossible to understand. On the one hand, at the age of 15, he could convince bands of seasoned warriors to risk their lives for him. He won spectacular victories, and he laid the groundwork for an empire that survived him by almost two centuries. Impressive. On the other hand, he was super impulsive, a reckless provocateur, and a drunkard. He fought in the name of Islam, but at the same time, he did all sorts of things that the Quran forbids, seemingly without fearing the wrath of God. The melancholy that befell him after the loss of his favorite wife is also hard to square with his cruelty, which was extreme, even by the standards of the time. He will always remain something of a mystery, I guess. After Chaldiran, his aura of invincibility was of course seriously tarnished, even to himself. His early military success had bolstered his credibility, but once his luck ran out, the opposite would happen. This might explain his depression. It may also hint to the reason for his retreat from the affairs of state. No longer did his men blindly follow him as a messianic figure on a sacred mission. This also meant that this divine, see my divine, aura could not be passed on to his successors. Therefore, if the Safavids wanted their empire to survive, they would have to morph into a more bureaucratic state. This meant a rebalancing of internal factions in favor of the Persian bureaucrats and of Islamic scholars. The latter would become more important in legitimizing the regime. The Arab scholars and the Turkmen Kizilbash were at a grave disadvantage compared to the Persian officials, however. They could not converse with most of the people that now fell under their sway, and they could not trust them either, since they had no personal ties with them. So slowly but surely, the Persians seemed to become the stronger force. This went hand in hand with the Safavids' transformation from a messianic movement to a centralized bureaucratic state. Not that everyone was on board with that transformation. Ismail's son, Tahmasp I, could keep things together by striking a balance between the different groups. The ethnic cleavages between Arabs, Turkmens, and Persians posed an opportunity for him to divide and rule. But this would not work indefinitely. Much depended on the skill of the guy on top of the pyramid. If that person was weak, the house of cards would collapse. We've seen what this could lead to earlier. For instance, when Nadir Shah's army unraveled, partly along ethnic lines. By the end of Tahmasp's reign, something similar seemed afoot. By the 1580s, Iran was torn apart by Kizilbash governors, the descendants of the men who had won the empire for the Safavids. They'd become an entrenched elite by then, vying with each other to maximize their grip on land, riches, and power. The Shah himself became a pawn in their hands. They quarreled over who would control him. But of course, he still had some power, if only due to his title. When Ismail II ascended the throne, he ordered the execution of the rival princes, as well as of all opposing Kizilbash leaders. It was as if he said, "Enough with the divide and rule already, obey me or else." As if this did not make him dangerous enough, he also intended to reverse the anti-Sunni policy, just now that the Persians had at last gotten used to it. Because imagine for a second that you are being forced to change your religion. At first, you hold a grudge, no doubt, and in your heart, you continue to believe like you did before. But what about your kids? What do you teach them about religion? Do you tell them to ignore the official policy, that it's all false? Then be mindful of the possible consequences if your child lets something slip to the wrong person. I suspect most Persians at the time raised their children as Shiites, or at least not as fervent anti-Shiites. And these kids would later raise their own children, just like the government intended it. Well, more or less at least. For a modern analogy, we might look to Hong Kong. Right now, most people there will fret about their lost rights, now that they've been absorbed by China. But coming generations may vaunt the merits of one-party communism. Our deepest beliefs and wishes are determined by history at some invisible level. Culture dictates what we can think, and culture is not seldom the product of violence. Most Iranians today may consider themselves devoted Twelver Shiites, but if they know their history, they will be forced to consider that this would not be the case if not for Ismail's violent indoctrinations. But here's the thing. Do you think, even for a second, that this is any different with me or you? What does that say about us, right? If I were born in Iran, I would probably be a Twelver Shiite myself. For me, this is an argument for mild judgment. Anyway, knowing that Iran is still staunchly Shiite, you can guess that Ismail II's plans did not come to fruition. Unsurprisingly, he was soon found dead, together with his lover. Yes, a man again, and no one blinked an eye about that. The two of them had supposedly overdosed on opium, which was also rather typical. In certain respects, these were liberal times in this region. The Kizilbash then saw their chance to enthrone the Shah's brother as the nominal emperor. But soon, one of his sons would change the situation drastically. In a way, he would pick up the work where his uncle had left it. This Shah, then still a boy, would become known as Abbas the Great. Now, there are a few things that you can guess whenever someone goes by the epithet the Great. He will have had a big impact, of course, usually something to do with military victories. But also, he will almost always be freaking ruthless. We've come across a few other rulers known as the Great already. I forgot who said this, but there's a famous line that says that great men are almost always evil men. It reminds me of the returning discussions about the name of Ivan Grozny. In the West, we know this Russian Tsar as Ivan the Terrible, and if you read about what he did, it's no wonder how he would get such a nickname. But Russians will point out that Grozny simply means impressive. Perhaps we mediocre people should be proud of not being so great, don't you think? After all, these saviors, who really needs them? But of course, that's easy to say for me, as I live in relatively safe times. It was different for Iranians in the time of Reza Khan the Great, say. We've seen that the founders of Iranian dynasties were so often men who stood for fear and blood. Perhaps you can't hope to pull off such feats like they did if you're a sweet person, not in such conditions. Abbas the Great was not strictly speaking the founder of his dynasty, but he did preside over some sort of second founding. And yes, he too was freaking merciless. From afar, he even looks a bit like Ivan the Terrible. Ivan was terrorized by the Bojar nobility during his youth. They had his mother killed, as well as his beloved wife, Anastasia. Yet he would exact bloody revenge on them, thereby strengthening his own authority. How satisfying it must be if things you passionately want to do happen to fit your political agenda as well. Likewise, Abbas was traumatized by the Kizilbash in his youth. His mother had managed to become regent to the Shah, but this ensured her of the hatred of the Kizilbash barons, so they broke into the harem and stabbed her to death while the Shah watched on in horror. This instilled in Abbas a lifelong trauma and a tendency for paranoia. He too would get his revenge, but he had to bide his time. The bickering between rival Kizilbash was the signal for Iran's enemies to attack. By 1585, Tabriz had again fallen to the Ottomans, and this time they intended to stay. They annexed a huge chunk of land and scores of Iranians were marched off into slavery. It was in these dark hours that the Kizilbash governor of Herat, in today's Afghanistan, made a bold move. He declared that the prince in his custody was now the new Shah. This prince was the 10-year-old Abbas. He was not the first in line, and he would not have become Shah if not for the opportunistic help of his Kizilbash regent. It took some time before his father abdicated, but by his 18th birthday, Abbas was crowned. It's hard to imagine what this kid had already had to endure at such a tender age. Yet he wouldn't forget nor forgive any of it, and he would soon be in a position to exact his revenge. One of the first to fall victim to his purges was his former regent, the very person who had enabled his rise. After having eliminated the most important Kizilbash chiefs, he went on to challenge them as a group. That he got away with this was partly because they had become divided and because they had depleted their forces in wars against foreign foes as well as against each other. The people had had enough of their egotistic behavior and longed for stability. Abbas could provide that stability. His position was later strengthened by his performance on the battlefield, but he had to follow the tactic of reculer pour mieux sauter. He couldn't afford to fight on two fronts simultaneously, so he first made a tactical peace with the Ottomans, on humiliating terms even. He was willing to give up land and even the habit of cursing the first caliphs, for he understood that he needed peace in the West at all costs, because only then he would have a free hand to push the Uzbeks from his land. After he did that, he turned on the Ottoman occupiers again. He managed to win astonishing victories. In 1623, he even recaptured Baghdad and its surroundings after nearly a century, as well as the Shiite holy places in southern Iraq. Like Ismail, he took command himself, which earned him huge respect from the common troops, whose devotion shifted once more from their tribal chiefs to the Shah. To perpetuate that state of affairs, Abbas dismembered whole tribes and molded them into a standing army. Many Kizilbash tribesmen were resettled so that they could act as buffers against raiders and invaders. This is how Nadir would be taken captive by the Uzbeks, if you'll recall. It was also one of the reasons why the tribes would be so upset by the end of the Safavid reign. Abbas's army reforms also went against Kizilbash preferences and interests. He turned the Safavids into a true gunpowder empire. In general, the Persians considered firearms less important. We've already talked about the practical reasons for that. Iran had a lot of good cavalry country. Ismail I counted on that when he taunted the Ottomans despite his far smaller numbers. But there were also emotional reasons why the Kizilbash were cool about gunpowder. They still had one leg in steppe culture, and they found firearms dishonorable and unmanly, probably because they required less skill than shooting a bow and less bravery than fighting with a scimitar. This sort of snobbery also existed among samurai and Mamluks, for instance, and it would in time cost them all dearly. In war, one cannot afford such romantic considerations. Abbas didn't take these sensitivities into account. On the contrary, if his army reform diminished the importance of the Kizilbash cavalry, all the better. The conquests laid the foundations for a stronger central state. Abbas, as leader of the army, could claim a lot of the occupied lands for the crown. He also confiscated land from those Kizilbash that had fallen out of favor. This new crown land included important silk-growing regions, which provided a welcome boost of income that could be used to further centralize authority. So the state actively helped develop a flourishing silk industry. There was no shortage of clients. Persia lay right on the Silk Road. The sale of silks to the Ottomans, even during wartime, provided precious silver, which could be used to import products that Iran did not make itself, mostly from India. For Shah Abbas, trade was the lifeblood of the state, and he did everything he could to keep the roads safe, for instance, organizing road police and caravanserais for the merchants. In contrast to earlier and later periods of chaos, under Abbas and his successors, Persia was known as a paradise for traveling salesmen. There was a catch, however. The trade was run by heathens. Christians and Jews had access to the Ottoman Empire, Hindus to India. But in a country that zealously imposed Shia Islam, the position of such minorities was precarious. At times, there would be strict rules targeting them. For example, Jews would at some point be forced to attach a colored fabric to their clothing. They were not allowed to respond if they were insulted by a Muslim, and their testimony was of no value, in principle at least. Thus, anti-Semitism in Iran is not a recent phenomenon. Ironically, it may well be that the policy of economic openness also opened Iran to anti-Semitic influences from places like Portugal. And indeed, like with the Jews in Europe, the success of these trading communities could breed resentment. There was an enormous trade deficit with India, and Indian traders, or Hindus, were held responsible for this constant shortage. Hindus were also exempt from the Islamic prohibition on charging interest, so many became successful moneylenders. Consequently, they also got a bad rap for usury. Luckily, the intolerance was moderated for the sake of trade, and wiser shahs understood that these communities were useful allies precisely because they were so isolated. In fact, Abbas forced Christians from the Caucasus to move to his new capital, Isfahan. He wanted them to set up a trading community there. As a plus, they could no longer stoke any unrest in their region of origin. This policy towards minorities was not limited to trade. Abbas, in essence, wanted to create new specialized elites, sealed off from society at large, so that he could control them. And religious minorities were the perfect candidates. On them, he wanted to build a parallel state structure, completely loyal to him. But where to find such people, and how to enlist them? Well, silk was not the only reason why Abbas was so keen on war in the Caucasus. Just as important were the people who lived there. He could not enslave other Muslims, although Uzbek and Ottoman ulama sanctioned the enslavement of Shiites. But no one would dispute that you could enslave Christians. So these were in high demand, and the easiest place to find them was in the Caucasus. Unfortunately for them, the Ottomans were interested in that region too, for the same reason. So this region would become one of the big battlegrounds between these two giant powers. Some of the captives were given great responsibilities. Christian slaves became prominent in the army, for instance. Just like in the Ottoman Empire, where the famous Janissaries were also Christian slaves. The Kizilbash resented this novelty, of course, but the Persians didn't. They were eager for anything that would curb Turkish influence. As this puzzle of ethnic factions became more fragmented, this played right into the cards of the Shah. By the way, I think this shows you that the tolerance of Abbas was not a sign of enlightenment or sympathy. He only liked minorities because he could use them. If he had to enslave or forcibly settle them first, then so be it. Paradoxically, another group that would continue to gain influence were the ulama. As the Kizilbash fell from grace, so did their favored sort of Islam, Sufism. It had been useful to inspire fidelity in their commander, who was often also the sheikh, but Abbas didn't want warriors to be loyal to their sheikhs, he wanted them to follow the Shah. Like Ivan Grozny, instilled the idea of a good tsar, as opposed to the corrupt nobility, Abbas promoted the image of the good Shah.
and also with some success. The appeal of Sufism had become an obstacle to the development of stable institutions. Abbas needed officials, not mystics, so he favored the ulama. In turn, they made themselves subordinate to him. They recognized, for instance, that he had the right to rule in the absence of the imam, which went against the grain of Shiite doctrine. For his part, the Shah supported the principle that every believer should follow the opinions of a high-ranking cleric, or marja. This mightily strengthened their influence on common believers, of course. It also stiffened the hierarchy within the Shiite church, if you will, which made it easier to control, since the highest-ranking clergy nearly always had close ties to the court, like under the Qajars, by the way. In time, this would lead to criticism, but that is a story for another episode. As so often, the highs of Abbas's period already contained the seeds of the Safavids' eventual decline. The increasing influence of ulama would eventually put a stop to the relative tolerance of the state, culminating in Milesi's Islamic Revolution. The ulama didn't stay an isolated minority forever, and even if there had been an uninterrupted inflow of foreign scholars, it wouldn't have made any difference. This trick could only be pulled off once. For as centers of Shiite learning emerged, there inevitably appeared an indigenous class of well-connected clerics. These men of the faith became less and less dependable. Their increasing influence boded ill for non-Islamic minorities, as well as for the economy, as we saw in the last episode. Shah Hussein even carried out some sort of Islamic revolution, with some regulations that were even stricter than today. Women were no longer allowed to leave the house, for instance. The regulations were often ignored, what's new, right? But minorities were still widely targeted. The fact that they were indispensable to trade, that didn't help them. If anything, it made them more hated even. As for the Kizilbash and other tribes, I already mentioned that their forced displacement would plant the seeds of their later aggression. Some of these tribes, and especially the Qajars, would yet come to dominate Iran's history for centuries to come. Ironically, Abbas the Great, the man who had finally reined them in, unintentionally facilitated their resurgence. He had gained experience as a military leader, even at a young age, and thus gained respect. That had facilitated the deposal of his father. But in his head, a voice kept whispering that his own sons might do the same to him one day. So he locked them away in a harem, where they would learn almost nothing useful. His paranoia then drove him to execute and blind his sons, so that he eventually had to be succeeded by a grandson. So the new Shah would be malleable, if only because of his very young age. Consequently, he could be manipulated by others, including prominent Kizilbash. They siphoned off much of Iran's wealth. And they also made sure that the army became more divided, and there would be less investment in gunpowder. The worsening financial situation necessitated budget cuts anyway. These were all things that would contribute to the Safavids' fatal military defeat against the Afghans much later. Abbas's reign had been a high watermark in other respects too. This was still a time in which the most important economic activity was farming, and agriculture was also the most important source of state income. The problem with that was that Persia had relatively little good farmland, which gave it a structural disadvantage against the Ottomans. The conquest of the fertile Crescent by Abbas solved this problem for a spell, but shortly after his death, the Ottomans managed to take it back. In the Treaty of Sohab in 1639, the Safavids agreed to lose their most profitable provinces in Mesopotamia and the Western Caucasus to the Ottomans. The only upside was that this bought them generations worth of peace. The later Safavid period, though often marked as one of decline, must have been rather good to be alive in, compared to the standards of the time at least, and to what came before and after. Peace is its own reward, and it also pays economic dividends, but at the same time, it's a trap. In peacetime, the army has little practice, and the leaders of the country, no longer facing an existential threat, start to focus on their own petty rivalries. When eventually a storm breaks, those who have known nothing but peace and prosperity are not ready for it. But that, of course, is the story of last episode. And perhaps, I sometimes wonder, perhaps it's a story that also applies to many of us. I hope you enjoyed the show. Talk to you soon.